please dial star 611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces. Welcome to TalkingAnthropology.com on SignalHackerspaces.org. My name is Thomas Loninger, and today's show is about Japanese hacker culture. My two guests are Mitch Altman from San Francisco Noise Pitch Hackerspace and Akiba from the first Tokyo Hackerspace. We'll talk about the rise of the hacker maker scene in Japan, cultural differences between the island and the rest of the world, geeks in Japan, and at the end also about open hardware definition 1.0 and how to do cool things with microcontrollers. Today's audio quality is sadly not the best because we had Mitch sitting in San Francisco, I was in Vienna, and Akiba was in Tokyo, so obviously I couldn't control their microphone setups. But I hope you still enjoy today's show. If you do, or if not, then please leave me a comment at talkingantropology.com. And now we start the show with Akiba introducing himself.
I was born in California and born and raised in California, and I'm Chinese, so I'm an American-born Chinese. And then I moved to Japan. I moved to Tokyo actually, chasing after my girlfriend. And then after I moved here, then we ended up breaking up, but I ended up staying. And so I've been living here for, eight years or 9 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. I write a lot of open source software, and I specialize in open source protocol stacks, like communication software. And I also design open source hardware. Mm-hmm. And me and a couple of other people, then we started Tokyo Hackerspace about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And from there, it's been crazy because we've been doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I think Mitch had some important role in the founding of this hackerspace. And Mitch, maybe you can introduce yourself. I mean, I know you quite well, but no one can speak better for himself than you can.
I'm known to different people from different things that I do, but I'm an inventor and a writer. I invented TV Begone remote controls, a keychain that turns TVs off in public places, and I write for Make magazine, and I'm currently writing a book about how to make cool things with microcontrollers for people who know nothing, and I am a co-founder of NoiseBridge, San Francisco Hackerspace, and I go around the world doing workshops and helping hackerspaces any way I can and poking people relentlessly to start hackerspaces everywhere I go. And when I was in Japan for the Make Tokyo meeting, which is what they call their maker fairs over there, their third one, I was at a bar camp, which was started by an expat friend of mine from the UK, Matthew Caramoon, and it was really wonderful bar camp, and I did a talk on how to start a hackerspace. And during my talk, there was a 19-year-old woman who was totally psyched about the whole thing. She's Japanese, and she actually got the domain for Tokyo Hackerspace during the talk, I believe, and within a few weeks, the hackerspace in Tokyo was actually live and running in their own space. It's pretty amazing how fast things can happen there. It took NoiseBridge over a year to get our first space in San Francisco. So, and that's one of the things that seems about Japan, that if an outsider comes in and just becomes a spark for something to happen, which is often needed over there, it seems to me, because tradition there is quite long. And if an outsider comes in with something new, it'll either be totally ignored or it'll be totally embraced and people will cruise with it. And then a combination of insider Japan people and outsiders like expats can really make it happen. Takes the Japanese people to do it because the culture in a lot of ways is not all that open. I mean, it's very warm and friendly and inviting. But outsiders often have kind of a slow going of getting involved with things. Once an idea can take hold with the help of some outsiders, it takes Japanese insiders to really make it happen in combination with the outsiders. That's sort of my take. I don't know what you think, Akiva.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's basically true. I think let's see. How should I put it? So I think in school and like in Japan schools and everything, then you're kind of taught to try and think the same way and not really kind of step out of line. And actually, it's changing a lot now with the internet, where like a lot of the misfits are starting to kind of come up, and they're actually, you know, they're actually kind of falling by the wayside in terms of the academics, which is traditionally horrible in Japan. But then those misfits are actually turning into like the artists and the musicians and things, and like really creative people. But yeah, it in general, I think it's difficult to it's difficult to try and to get embrace new ideas unless like, you know, unless there's some kind of you know, like Mitch coming in and talking about the hackerspace, who has actually talk about hackerspaces, who actually has experience working and starting them. And then after that, then things just happen really quickly. And I should also mention that since Mitch gave his talk on hackerspaces at the bar camp, then there are at least there is actually, I think, three other hackerspaces in Tokyo. One of them existed before Mitch gave his talk, but then that was just like kind of a closed space with four people and no membership allowed. But then since then, there have been an additional two spaces that have opened up to one of them at industrial design school, which was really nice.
Yeah, I met those people at the Make Tokyo meeting number 6. They're really wonderful, and they really want to expand. And from what they were saying, they're expanding pretty quickly.
Oh yeah. Well, the pictures on their site are awesome. I haven't been out there to the space yet.
Do any of you know something about the space that pre-existed before Mitch's talk?
Yeah, Mitch went there.
Oh, go ahead.
Actually, since you hung out at Anchor Labs, then probably best for you to talk about it.
Well, you've been there too, right?
No. They're actually they're right next to us, but yeah, we haven't really we talk a little bit, but we don't really we don't hang out that much. But actually, recently they moved next to Tokyo Hackerspace, so we should hang out more.
Yeah, like I don't know, like 3 blocks away or something. Yeah, they're really cool people. There's I'm really bad with names, sorry. The person that started it does some pretty interesting things with music, and he is probably best known for creating this system where he hooks electrodes to his face.
Yeah.
do you remember his name?
I forgot. It's SH. He's fairly well known though, especially in the technology artist community, and people doing like kind of really interesting work with technology and art and music. But his name escapes me right now. I'm also bad with names, and it's early in the morning.
It's kind of a geek trait to be bad with names. But anyways, he hooks these electrodes to his face, and it's hooked to a music synthesizer. And as the music plays, his face twitches in time to the music. And I was at a conference in Boston where he happened to be there as well after we met in Japan. And he had a whole room full of people hooked to the same system, and their faces were choreographed to twitching in time to this one synthesizer. It was pretty comical. And so he also does other cool things with hardware and music. He has this one thing, which is a little translucent cube that's full of, it has red, green, and blue LEDs that have different intensities. And when you mix together red, green, and blue, you can get all sorts of different colors, just like on your computer monitor. That's how it makes colors. And it also has a microphone. And as people in the audience walk into the performance space, they're given one of these little cubes to hold in their hands. And then they play music, which has color command information embedded in the music. The music itself is the commands that the microphone picks up, and then the little cube, the microcontroller in the cube, knows how to blink the color sequences in time to the music, and it's really beautiful. So they showed me that when I was over there, and I showed them my brain machine, which was kind of a hit there, and they've had they had a lot of fun with it. They even put a video of it up on their website. So Brain Machine is glasses that are very photogenic, that blink lights and make sound at a sequence of meditation brainwave frequencies. And you hallucinate along the way as you're having a nice meditation. So yeah, it was really nice to hang out with them. It is a small space. They have only four people, and they're not really looking to expand, but these four people work really well together, and they create all sorts of projects, which are quite often very complex, including having the red, green, blue thing and these huge balloons that they were paid to release in a very large rock concert. To fill a hall with these balloons that people could bounce around and play with, and also a Rube Goldberg machine, which they have a video up on their website called the Way Sensing Go, which sounds like a very Japanese turn of phrase to me, but it uses sensors on computer monitors as part of the Rube Goldberg machine. So it's an interesting combination of all these mechanical things and virtual things that all happen sequentially to perform a totally useless and beautiful task. So this place is, the reason I found out about it is before I gave my talk at Barcamp, I looked on hackerspaces.org and the list of hackerspaces to see if there was anything in Japan, because I'd never heard of anything there. And they had just put their entry up about a few days before Barcamp. And that's how I found out about them. And and although they're not really looking for new members, they're very welcoming for people to visit if you contact them.
Mm. A strange coincidence that they come up the wiki just before you go to the country, and then the whole thing gets going. I also wanted to say Brain Machine is one of your inventions, and I have one at home, and it works. One question. I mean, as you know, I would like to come also to the cultural questions concerning Japan. And you think that some of the projects you just mentioned are typically Japan? Because it's, like you said, they are very sophisticated. They have a high degree of professionality to them. And when I think of Japanese culture, it always is to me something like they're a perfectionist, and they don't want to just do something with failures, at least not show it in public that they have done something, some piece of art or any product work, which is not something they could completely stand upon, you know?
So I think the perfectionist, I think that's kind of, it's kind of true and kind of not. like in terms of like the Japanese people as perfectionists and that kind of idea. That's like the same as thinking that women are similar to the girls in anime, and Japanese women are similar to the girls in anime, which is like kind of, yeah, certain ones, but so.
All cultural statements which go over a whole group are never completely true. They're all generalizations, but sometimes there lies a piece of truth in them.
And that's I think historically then it's true. I mean, like, Japanese culture is, like, heavily based on, Zen, which really looks to, you know, I guess, which really looks, tries to find, like, the deeper meaning in everything. And so, like, and a lot of, like, Japanese, swordsmiths or, like, artists, like, woodblock artists or, like, samurai or, like, swordsmen, tried to perfect their skills, things like that. But I think, I think sometimes like trying to perfect everything, kind of hinders, creativity as well. Because you're trying to do one thing and one thing until perfect according to like the standards of perfection, you know. Because there is no perfect without any kind of a standard for it.
A short example, because I completely agree with what you said. When I learned jiu-jitsu as a child, it was also like we had a Japanese teacher. And as an exception, he told it in a Japanese way. We had to repeat and repeat and repeat everything until it was perfect in his eyes, you know. It was repetition till perfection was something like a motto.
Yeah, I think in some ways that's good. There needs to be a lot of repetition and technique. But I think a lot of the kids, like that's what they teach in school too. But I think a lot of the kids are kind of rebelling against that and kind of trying to develop their own voice for like whatever they're working on. So I think a lot of like the makers in Tokyo that I'm seeing, they're really developing like their own voice in terms of like their creations, and it's really interesting because Japan is kind of isolated from the rest of the world, especially geographically, but you know also in terms of language, etc. And then so the scene here is kind of developed on its own based on like the limitations within Japan, and so you know the maker scene is very interesting because of that, because it's a lot different than like say in the US.
Yeah, you know, one of the main things with the hacker scene internationally is you know, hacker culture is you don't have to be perfect. Hacking something together, that turn of phrase is really about, you know, putting, you know, just doing it. It doesn't matter if it's professional or not. Professionalism is for corporations, and it's just an arbitrary style. It's not the best way. It's just a way, and you can put something together any way you like. And if it does what you expected, cool. You can share it with other people, and it might be really cool. But if it doesn't, you know, what did you learn from the experience? And you can share that as well. So when everything has to be perfect, I mean, in the West too, there's certainly a lot of self-censorship because of that. If we have to have everything we do be worthy of, you know, the image we expect of ourselves, then, we really can't get very far very quickly because we're never going to start. We're afraid we might fail. So I think, there's certain things in Japan and the West in that regard. Although maybe from a slightly different cultural background. But there's another thing too in Japanese culture that I find that makes it difficult for people to collaborate outside of a work environment and in the hacker scene. You know, when everything, everyone has to, well I guess let me say it like this, Japan has a long history of everyone being in their place, you know, like with China, with Confucianism, born out of a time period when everything was incredibly chaotic and things were falling apart, Confucius came along and created a bunch of simple rules so that everyone knew their place, and then things could start to make sense again, and everyone had their place in the family, and everyone has their place in government, and in more modern times in your work environment, all the relationships are clearly defined. And with such a long history of this, you don't really have a lot of individualism that's looked up to as a good thing, and people seem to be afraid of sticking their head up, otherwise it might get chopped off. And so it's really important, though, in a collaborative environment for people to go, hey, what about this cool idea? Or, hey, look at this cool thing that I'm doing. Anyone want to help? What was surprising to me at the most recent Make Tokyo meeting, number 6, is the difference between it and Make Tokyo meeting number 3, which was just a year and a half earlier. There were a lot more collaborative projects and a lot more people and more enthusiastic presentation of their cool projects, either individual or collective, collaborative. So things do seem to be catching on that way, where people are breaking free of that long tradition of not sticking your head up. And that's sort of another cultural thing that I perceived is actually, I lost my train of thought there, so someone else did pick it up.
Yeah, oh. I have another question to something you just said, because it's this difference between the Tokyo meeting number 3 and 6, and I know that you always do your soldering workshops at such events. And have you noticed any difference in teaching soldering to people in Japan than at other places, like, for example, the States or Europe? Also, have you seen any difference between these meetings you attended? For example, the first and the most recent one.
It's certainly more popular between the one I was just at in November and the one a year and a half earlier. And that's true internationally. The whole hardware hacking thing is becoming more popular as the whole hacker scene has become more popular. I think the main difference in Japan and elsewhere that I've done these workshops is probably the reluctance of people to start because they think they might not be good. And my workshops, I make it really easy to teach people and also really fun. And I have all these intriguing blinking light thingies, projects that I have explicitly for teaching people who've never done anything before, you know, make them intriguing enough to people to want to try, even if they think they might not be good. Blinky light things, noisemaker things, TV be gone, brain machine, interactive art projects, whatever, all these little things. And so it attracts people, but there does seem to be a little more reluctance in Japanese culture in general, to try and start. So I've got to, push and poke a little bit more to get people to try. But once they get into it, they really get into it. And maybe another difference is once people get into it, there's probably more of a total engagement with the process. You know, like these people are way into it, and people will ask for help if they need it. But if they don't, they're just in their own little world cruising along. But if there's a whole bunch of people at the table soldering, which there usually is, people are very good at helping one another as they are elsewhere in the world.
I should also mention that, like, when I was watching Mitch at the last Tokyo Make meeting, then he was attracting quite a few children to soldering as well. And I think, part of it is they don't have, like, the inhibitions or, you know, self-consciousness. And so they just, like, go straight up to him, you know, this tall foreigner, that's teaching soldering, and you know, and basically they're just asking him to teach them how to solder. It was really cute.
The kids there are amazing. Kids everywhere are totally into this stuff. You give them a chance, and if the parents let them cruise, they go for it. I've taught kids as young as four everywhere I go, you know, particularly geeky kids, but, you know, kids 8 on up, it doesn't really matter how geeky. But the kids over in the Make Tokyo meeting were really amazing. There's so many brilliant kids that were there. It's just, blew me away. And with no inhibitions at all about going up to people and asking them about their projects and, pretty sophisticated questions. And also as I'm walking around, taking a break from my soldering workshop area, and looking at other people's projects, these little kids were going up and using, the projects that were available for kids to use. And one of the things I just really loved was this really simple project of, a matrix of push buttons that lit up different colors, and it's a music input device with MIDI, and it was hooked up to a synthesizer, sequencer, and it was really a simple interface for making repetitive loop music. And the person who set it up, the exhibit, and created this project, made it really easy for people to just come up and try it. And right before it caught my eye because there are all these blinking lights, and, you know, I'm a geek, so I'm attracted to that as well. this little three-year-old kid, 3 years old, got there before me, and he starts playing with it, and he's making this incredible music composition that was very much reminiscent of Steve Reich, a 20th century music composer. And, you know, he was there for like 15 minutes, totally engaged. And I'm not sure I've ever seen anything like that before at any maker fair, no matter what it is. You know, it was somehow very Japanese for me. And I loved it, and the kid loved it, and the people at the exhibit loved it. It's an impression that sticks with me.
Classical music and hacker culture seems to be a very good combination. We had also a very genuine talk at last Chaos Communication Congress from some classical musicians, and Japan is particularly inflamed for classical music, and in Vienna you can see this because there are many, many Japanese tourists going around and going on the classical music tour and doing a lot of tourist stuff. Time is passing by, and I also would like to go something, talk a bit about the past and talk a bit about the future. But let's start with the past, and Akiba, you are only in Japan for the last 8 years, but maybe you can tell us something about the internet culture in Japan before this whole hacker thing started. I mean, there must have been something. Japan is such a technology loving country, and have you ever found out about groups who were there before the hacker meme hit the island?
There's actually a group that's very popular. They exist, like, basically they're an online group that's like kind of spread out over the across all of Japan, and they're called Nico Nico Engineering, and it started with this video sharing website like Nico Nico Doga, and then Nico Nico Engineering is just like a bunch of people that kind of, it's like a social circle for like really geeky makers. And, they have a big presence in the whole Japan making scene. But I think before like the whole, you know, I think before like kind of Make Magazine came to Japan, and, you know, and it was kind of accepted that people like tech geeks could be artists as well. Before that, then I think that it was like the whole tech scene was very underground, like like, you know, basically like tech people were normally considered geeks, like otaku in Japanese. You know, and you would see them around Akihabara. Like when I told people that I hang out in Akihabara, they're like, oh, you're otaku. Like, yes, I actually am. But now it's gaining kind of like more cachet as Mitch mentioned, the make meetings and the whole kind of technology art scene is getting more popular and becoming a higher profile. It's getting media coverage too, and so they're starting to become like a cachet to being like, you know, a tech person.
Yeah, like with the rest of the world. And you know, it really struck me the first time I went to Tokyo and going to Akihabara. There's all of these stores that sell outrageous numbers and variety of pretty much any electronic part you could want or need. And that's really never existed anywhere, but it really exists there. And there used to be part stores all over the place, in the US and Europe, but there really aren't anymore. And Akihabara is still thriving. And I wondered, you know, like who are the people who buy all these parts? And
that would be me. It was similar to me.
but it was all of these individual hobbyists that don't talk to one another and didn't talk to one another enough to support this whole area of town full of parts stores. And so it's all these people who are working in their job from whatever, 7 a.m. till like 8 p.m. or whatever, and going to Akihabara buying parts, and on weekends doing their own individual projects without communicating with one another. And I think that's what's really changed in recent times with Make Magazine and Maker Fairs or Make Tokyo meetings and the hackerspace scene, as Japan, the wave of this whole hackerspace movement and maker movement is hitting Japan. So people are collaborating with the internet and through hackerspaces and the meetings, etc. So it's really cool to see when things change in Japan, they tend to change rather quickly.
Yeah, I should also mention that there's a lot more collaboration going on right now, and just like, you know, and maybe about 9 months ago, they actually opened up an art center inside Akihabara, which was just like, it completely blew me away. And a lot of the art is focused on technology. And actually, inside of the art center, they have a soldering cafe, which is, an open source hardware company. They actually rented one of the, spaces in the museum. And then half of it is used for them to, like, you know, pack and ship their products, like the hardware products. And the other half is to, people can rent it out to teach classes, or people can just go there and use their soldering irons. And they also teach classes on how to use like different like Arduinos and other open source hardware type of projects. And so that's just one area where, you know, like collaboration is happening, and that kind of thing is enabling like having an art gallery, and inside the art gallery you can learn how to use the technology that's just pervasive around the area around Akihabara. And so, you know, you can have an idea, go buy the parts, go into the art space, solder it up together, and then display it all in the same day, you know, in the same place without, you know, without even leaving that area.
Just to explain this Akihabara is a part of Tokyo, which has a very long tradition in technology stores, and as Mitch just explained. And that's partly a reason for doing this show for me, because I wondered that it would suit the Japanese culture, at least I know it from it, very well to adapt this hacker culture, because they do love technology, and they certainly have a very creative way of using and modifying things. I mean, they modify nearly everything that comes from the West to adapt it to their way of life and make it fit. And so, why not with technology? It's only one part of it.
Yeah, all the elements are there, and Akihabara, this whole part of town with parts you can buy, is certainly a great resource. And all these incredible geeks that have been brought up in an incredibly good education system. And then with the internet, and Akiba has a really amazing video tour of Akihabara, which became internationally pretty famous. And so that's bringing more people to the whole scene as well. So as this starts to gel, it'll be really interesting to watch and see where it goes.
I guess because what me and Mitch were talking about Akihabara and all the geeks and all the hardcore techies that hang out there, that's actually kind of like a, you know, maybe that's like the base of Akihabara, but I think within the last 2 years I've been seeing a lot of people that would normally not fit into the Akihabara scene be there. You know, like these were like a lot of people that would be more like in the more fashionable areas like Shibuya or something like that, Harajuku. And so there's actually a whole new crop or a whole new audience of people that are coming to Akihabara right now, and they're learning and they're trying to learn about the electronics and or music or whatever. So that's one thing that's really interesting too, is that there's like an evolution going on in Akihabara where like different types of people are now coming in.
Yeah, like the mix of the art and urban hipster crowds and whatever.
Yeah, basically. I guess that's a good way to put it, is like the hipster. The hipsters are invading.
Yeah, well, it's an obvious match because everyone loves blinky lights and noise making and whatever. And if it can make cool music and art, then it brings together even more people.
Yeah.
I have to come back to 2008 and all these changes you two explain. Do you really think that the journey of Mitch and Hacker Spaces idea has an influence in this opening on the fact that people do now many things more in the public and collaborate more? And was this something the people came up with themselves, or just naturally because I don't know, the internet connected certain elements of society in a way which wasn't there before?
Take a crack at this one. I think it wasn't. I don't think it was any one event. First of all, I think there's a large group of like otaku that have been doing everything, you know, that are basically disconnected. So there were like a lot of islands of makers that existed, and then so around 2006, 2007, then Japan started getting exposed to like social networking, so people were able to kind of find out that other people were also interested in what they were doing. And then the Make magazine came to Japan, which I think was a huge influence. You know, and there's already a lot of technical publications, but Make magazine actually focuses a lot on the art aspect, which kind of appealed to a lot of like the hipster crowd, and also females, which is important. And then Karamoon, Matt Karamoon, started the bar, held the first Tokyo bar camp. And, at that bar camp, and there were a lot of, interesting topics that, you know, well, first of all, I think the concept of a bar camp was, very unique in that there was no structure. And so people could just talk about whatever they want. And then Mitch, when he talked about the hackerspaces and the collaboration, and that, you know, it was really a combination of everything, in my opinion, that is like kind of propelling the whole Tokyo hacker scene.
Yeah, as with everywhere in the world, there's no one thing, but the time is just right. And this whole thing has been exploding in 2007 for the Chaos Communications Camp in summer of 2007. There were only a handful of hackerspaces in the whole world, and now we're approaching 900 existing or forming. So, you know, there's a lot of things that come into play, and there's no one event, like you said, Akiba, that makes it all happen, but they all feed into each other. So Make Magazine, Maker Faires, Hacker Spaces, Hacker Conferences, and also that the internet is really open, and wikis, not just Wikipedia, but all sorts of wiki websites where everyone is welcome to join in and change the websites, and websites that have do-it-yourself projects, and not just for electronics, but for craft and art and music and video and food and, you know, whatever people want to teach and learn and share. And the time just seems to be right for all of this everywhere in the whole world, on every continent except Antarctica. So even there's some hacking going on there at the science stations that have been set up there. And there's even been someone who bought a TV gone so they can say the TVs have been turned off with TV gone on every continent. You know, Japan has been isolated for so long, but it's hooked together with the whole world through the internet, through all the people traveling through these international communities. And, you know, we're all human underneath, regardless of the cultural overlays. We all have an innate curiosity to learn and share and support one another, because that's why we exist as a species on a planet and haven't been wiped out by the bizarre environment we were born into. You know, that's what's driving this whole scene, is we really need to support each other. We need everyone around the planet needs to express themselves through their creativity, and hacker culture is really perfect for all that.
And where do you think it will go? Are there any interesting projects on the horizons, or maybe new spaces, or maybe some more remote parts of Japan? I mean, we've been talking a lot about Tokyo right now, but not about the rest of Japan.
So an interesting thing is, I believe last year, the Make meeting started spreading out to other areas of Japan. I mean, since it started, it was only in Tokyo, but then last year it was held in, I forgot where it was, but it was like pretty far outside of Tokyo. And I think the most important thing is for people, you know, like for people to see other people and the projects that they're working on. And so so by having the Make meetings outside of Japan, like say in Osaka and like, you know, even and further out, then as long as people are exposed, you know, in real life to the actual projects that they're seeing, like these cool projects that other people are working on, and that inspires them to work on their own projects as well. And I think that's how it's going to start spreading through all of how it's going to start spreading more through all of Japan, and how collaboration, and probably I'm expecting probably this year, or I think actually this year there should be a lot more hackerspaces in Japan as well, like outside of Tokyo.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, next time I go there, I'll have to poke people elsewhere too, and you will, and other people will, and I'm excited to see what'll happen. I have no idea where all this leads, but wow, it's cool to watch.
Definitely the hackerspaces.org list of hackerspaces is a good resource to see if new spaces are popping up or being planned, and we'll include some links for the show notes. But there's one question I always want to ask my guests, and that's the question of net neutrality and censorship in the internet in general. And maybe Akiba, you can tell us something about the state in Japan. Do you have a free internet? Are there any restrictions put in place, or is there a discussion about these things?
Oh, that's actually kind of an interesting question. I think in Japan, my feeling is that people are fairly apathetic to like those kind of topics, like internet freedom or net neutrality. And I think Japan has like probably one of the fastest internet, Japanese houses have like one of the fastest internet connections in the world. I mean, to my house, I have like a fiber coming in. I have 100 megabit per second line to the internet.
Wow.
And right now, it's like they're at like I think 160 megabits per second. You know, like for the newest services. But I think a lot. So before I lose my train of thought, but then a lot of people aren't really. The general population isn't very computer savvy, in my opinion, and I think that's because computers are kind of a new thing here. People started generally using computers probably in 2000, 2001. I mean, before 2000, in the 90s, like the dominant operating system was a proprietary operating system from, I believe, NEC. So there wasn't even like, you know, like a standard operating system like Windows or Mac or anything like that that was being used here. And so, like, computer usage, I think, is still kind of, like, within the geek realm. At least deep technical knowledge, or not even deep technical knowledge, but, like, being good with computers is still, like, makes you kind of, like, otaku here. And so saying that, I don't think people are that aware of, you know, internet freedom. They just expect it. And so I don't really hear the concepts of net neutrality, or censorship coming up. And I'm pretty sure that if the government decided to do it, they would do that. And I think, I would probably, suspect that most Japanese people would just accept it.
Now, are you aware of any, discussion on the political side or, things they've planned for the future, or general statements, at least, how they see the internet?
I think the Japanese government and politicians, mainly see the internet as Japan needs to be, be a major player in the whole internet scene in order, you know, from an economic standpoint, you know. And I think it's the same way with Korea, you know, it's like kind of a strategic economic area. But in terms of teaching people how to use it, you know, like having like high speeds is one thing, but teaching people how to use computers properly and how and what they can actually do, that's a different thing. I think Japan is actually lagging in people that understand how to use computers. I mean, most people access the internet just through their phones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not confirming the image I had of Japan, because I thought of it as a very technology-loving country, which is where every child is using computers, and it's through all of society.
Because you're talking about like maybe or. Maybe the image is more of like people using cell phones. People use cell phones a lot, and they're like there's a lot of people that are very sophisticated using cell phones, gaming consoles. But in reality, like general purpose personal computers to the mass market was mostly to people other than like really like, you know, geeks, where it was like probably came around to 2000, 2001 when Windows started becoming accepted as well. Because then people could actually use the software that was being developed worldwide rather than just using whatever was done on the proprietary OSs that was being circulated around Japan.
Coming back to politics, are there any organizations of the opposite side, I mean, opposed to the government maybe, or something comparable to 2600 or the Chaos Computer Club? You know what I mean, or this type of organization which deals for digital civil rights, something like that in Japan?
You mean like a you mean like something like a EFF?
Exactly. Like similar to the EFF? Yeah.
I don't think, as far as I know, there's nothing like that in Japan. I probably need to talk to somebody. There may exist. They may have something like that exists right now, but I haven't heard of it.
Mm-hmm. So definitely, at least it's not in the tech community a discussion point. Something you wouldn't read in a normal news, for example. It's not like that.
Yeah, I think I have a fairly decent, like, so people in Tokyo Hackerspace, then we have like a good network of like, you know, hearing what's going on in the tech scene in Japan. And, but I haven't heard of, you know, anything similar to the EFF in Japan. And if anyone listening to this knows about, like an effort like that or a group similar to that, then, please let me know. And actually, we'd like to invite them to the Hackerspace to give a talk then, because that's a very interesting topic for us.
Yeah, definitely. Good. And yeah, close to the EFF, something I want to ask Mitch about, because I think it's no news anymore, because it was, I think, a week ago, but the open source hardware definition has reached version 1.0. And I've seen this news item on various blog posts from the US till Beirut. So it seems to be, I don't know, something to celebrate.
Yeah, well, it is. It's, you know, open source is pretty new on the planet altogether. But open source used to refer only to software until very recently. Within the last few years, people have been doing open source hardware. And, you know, even for myself, when I first did TVGon, I did the, you know, so-called normal route of applying for a patent, which was easier for me since my brother's a patent attorney. But it was from starting to go to hacker conferences where I really saw that, well, you know, I always had mixed feelings about patents, you know, the One side of patents that's supposed to be cool is that it can protect a small-time inventor like myself and like Akiba and other people of our ilk to keep competition away. That's one of the ideas. But the way it's normally been used in the last several decades is a large corporation will make all these incredibly broad patents that aren't really appropriate and keep everybody away so that no one can really freely explore and invent and experiment because they'll send their lawyers after you. And basically the idea of a patent has become, this is mine, don't come near it or I will attack you. And that's really very different than this new paradigm that's been forming around open source and the whole hacker ethos of, look at this cool thing. I think it's really cool, and the more people use it, the cooler it is. So I'll help anyone. Here's all the information. Here's the documentation. And check it out. See what you think. And that's worked really well for me with TVGon. You know, I'm just one person, I had the help of a lot of friends that made TV Be Gone into an actual thing that can go out into the world that people can use to turn off TVs everywhere and make the world a better place. So when I first started going to hacker conferences and people saw patent pending on the package of TV Be Gone, there was a lot of negativity coming my way around that, which I could relate to. But I was also reluctant. It's like I spent a year and a half of my life gathering those codes and field testing and putting this whole thing together, and just some company that could come along that doesn't care at all about anything except making money could just take it if this got out. But from talking to lots of people at my first hacker conference, which was in 2006, it really turned me around. It keyed into what I didn't like about patents and opened up what I liked about my whole process of collaborating with all of my friends to make this whole thing happen, and also collaborating with people all around the world on the internet who gave me suggestions, which helped me make my project better. And so when I met Phil Terone and Lady Ada, two people who are huge proponents for open source hardware and this whole version 1.0 of the open source hardware spec, when I met them back in 2006 after my first hacker conference, that pushed me over the edge, and I made TVBGone open source. And it's worked incredibly well for me all the way around. And I found the more I give away my project, the documentation, help other people do whatever they want with it, the more money I make. And I didn't say earlier, but TVBGone is the only way I've made money since 2004. That's how I make a living.
Hey, and how many have you sold so far?
260,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a little over 250,000 people who are, just buying my commercially available one, going around the world, turning TVs off and enjoying it and making the world around them a better place for everybody. So, so the more I give this away, the more people make it. And for every person who makes it and I don't see a cent, they're, of course, very enthusiastic about it. And they tell all their friends and everyone who will listen what they just did. And most of those people, if they're going to have a TVBGone or something like it, they'll probably buy either my kit or my ready-made product. And then they'll tell people who will tell people. And for every one of the people who didn't buy one of my things, they build their own and they tell other people. So not only that, but some of the most incredible creative engineers around the world are working on my project incredibly enthusiastically, and they're doing it for free. I mean, what could be a better thing for not just me personally, but for the project and for the intent of the project, which is for people to go around the world happily turning TVs off, than for it to be open source? You know, so open source works really well. Go ahead.
But what stands the meaning of the hardware definition for open source hardware, which has reached this final first version? Speaking about licensing, we are always with one step in legal questions. And I guess this hardware definition does something similar, at least to the open source licenses we know from source code, from software. But there, I think it is important to focus or to speak about the new thing it introduces. You know, the legal side to it and the security that people can declare their hardware project to this license. And then also, if you have people going on working with some other work that has been carried out before, you know, this license stays the same, and the terms under which you can use this invention are equally shared between all the people, and it is a clear state, and you don't have to ask anyone about the rights they hold.
Yeah. So the agreement is that if it's going to be so if you're going to call yourself your project open source, there's basically three things that you share the information in a way that other people can use it. So it's using tools that are available, hopefully not really expensive ones, and you don't withhold any of that so that people actually can make your project. And another thing is that there's no commercial restriction. That was one of the things where there was some considerable debate, less than people had feared. But there is agreement on that. So if it's going to be called open source hardware, then there's no commercial restrictions. So not only can people freely make this thing, but they can also make it and compete with you. So the other thing is what you just said, Thomas, is that it has to be shared alike. So anyone can use it, but they have to have the exact same open source hardware licensing on it, meaning that you know, it's everything's freely available and anyone can use it without commercial restriction. So those are the three main points of open source hardware.
Yeah. Actually, also, I think the open source hardware definition, I don't think it really deals with the actual licensing. It's more of like kind of a formalization of what constitutes an open source hardware project. So I think most people, so Creative Commons share and share alike would also be considered open source hardware.
Well, it wouldn't be necessarily open source hardware. That's a way to license hardware.
An open source hardware license. Sorry, but
yeah. And back to the legal part of it is Creative Commons and GNU Public License and various others have been held up in court in the U.S. So if a corporation, for-profit corporation, has taken an open source project, using it for their commercial purposes, but not abiding by the rules of the license, like not making it open source, because if it's share alike and they don't share it likewise, they've been taken to court and have lost. So there is precedent behind this now, helped by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF here. The definition of open source hardware, as you said, Akiva, is in agreement of what the terms are or what the points are for you to be able to call it open source, and then you can license it any way you want. I've been doing all mine with Creative Commons, and so it would be attribute. Oh yeah, and that was another one I forgot, is you have to credit the person that you got the project from if you're going to use it. Mm-hmm. So I use attribution. I don't have a commercial restriction and share alike.
Mm-hmm. So you would go conform with the open source hardware definition, or there is no big difference between Creative Commons in the set you choose and the one that has been released recently?
I think the open source hardware definition isn't a licensing. It's just it's same as kind of like the open source, like the accepted open source software definition, or I guess the open source hardware definition, I think defines what constitutes an open source hardware, and then the license is free to be chosen by the individual. As long as it conforms to what's needed by open source in the open source hardware definition.
Yeah, you're right. It's maybe I put this wrong the way I said it. It's not a direct license, but it's like a terminology. It's like when you want to use this term for the stuff you do, then you have to conform to these several points listed in the definition. It's more a terminology question.
I'm pretty sure in the future there'll be they'll also list like what types of licenses conform to the open source hardware definition, like Creative Commons share alike, and then it's probably going to end up similar to like how there's like a like the open source the accepted open source software licenses as well.
Yeah.
I'm now realizing that maybe I should do another show about licensing and this jungle of Creative Commons, public domain. And I wanted to do it for science and licensing science and modern knowledge transfer, but that's probably another episode. Anything we've forgotten, anything you definitely want to talk about and I haven't asked you?
Let's see. For me, Just let's see. Well, I mean, I guess there's a lot of stuff to talk about, but yeah. You know, if whoever is listening to this is ever in Tokyo and want to check out Tokyo Hackerspace, feel free to drop by. We have meetings every Tuesday from 7 p.m. and you can actually check on the TokyoHackerspace.org website to find out like the location and the meetings.
You haven't told us about your project, Freak Labs.
Oh yeah, well there's a couple of them. I did a lot of hardware for wireless sensor networks, and recently I introduced the wireless version of the Arduino platform, which is this very nice platform. I mean, it's just like it's actually the platform that kind of set off a whole revolution in terms of who was able to do embedded programming and, you know, programming microcontrollers. But anyways, yeah, so, and right now I'm also working on, boards for people to learn, like how to learn electronics. And I'm also working on a very special board, which is going to be, like a low power version of the Arduino, like very low power. Like the idea is to get like over 6 months to a year of of life out in the field, and hopefully to try and, you know, actually I'm hoping to have an indefinite life. So it's also going to be able to be powered by solar, but I'm hoping that people will kind of take that up for like environmental monitoring. Like it might get used for academic research or something like that.
Could you go?
So I think that's something.
What's the usage of it? For what could you use such a Arduino-based device?
Oh, like, well, I mean, like, well, I think the Arduino is the method of implementation, and I think it's, like, the easiest way to get people involved and engaged. But I think the application itself is, like, some kind of a wireless sensor network or wireless sensor monitoring, and those are being used in really interesting places. So people are dropping wireless sensors into volcanoes to monitor volcano activity, the noxious gases inside, and things like that. People are using them for distributed weather stations to monitor like the weather changes over a geographic location. And for all of those things, you really, to deploy it remotely, then you really have to consider the power usage. And I think a lot of people are interested in these types of things. And if there is a way for them to easily program, you know, their own application and also be able to deploy it without having to, like, you know, go to the top of the volcano every week to, you know, change the batteries, then I think it can potentially have a lot of impact, I think, especially like maybe say farming and maybe like precision agriculture and things like that.
So using this small embedded device, which nearly needs no energy and which is very flexible, which can do many tasks, and they are done for field research, so you can put them somewhere and they measure the temperature, the air pressure, or whichever measurement is interesting for your particular issue. And your company is producing this hardware and helping people to use them in their own projects, or what do you do?
Well, actually, yeah, that project is one that I'll be introducing soon, but it's still in development. And then I have a bunch of other projects too, but I guess Freak Labs, I make the hardware, and also I write the the software, or at least the communications stacks for the hardware. And then the recent platform that I'm really liking is the Arduino platform, because there's a huge community of developers that are also developing software for it, and so people can just kind of take applications that other people have developed and use them, and they can be confident that it works. because the platform is the same. And that's always been the hardest part of working with microcontrollers, is everyone has their own custom platform.
Yeah, that's this platform idea is the thing we're seeing right now at smartphones, that you can, program for one platform and you can be sure that the whole platform can use your program. You're not programming only for one particular mobile phone, and then someone with the next model of the same company can no longer use your program. It's a similar thing now with microcontrollers, that you have this abstracted platform, Arduino in this case, and you're programming for this, and then you can reuse the code. You can, again, build upon the projects other people have done before and reuse the software. And also to explain Arduino in short, it is, I think it was started off in Italy as a art project, or for an art project. They developed this type of microcontroller, which is very easy to program, which is very robust. You can't destroy anything with failures in programming. At least that's what I was told. It is widely used, and I mean, maybe Mitch, you definitely know much more about Arduino, that's what I got from it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have much more to add. It's just a very easy to use microcontroller platform that anyone, including non-geeks, that's what it was designed for, like artists and other non-geeky people, to be able to use and share. So it is entirely open source, and so there are a lot of people, including Akiba, who make their own versions of Arduino platforms to give away or for sale. And yours will be the first one that's low power. One of the disadvantages of Arduino has been that if you run it off of batteries, the batteries will go dead. Like other projects where you can leave the battery in there and don't have to have an off switch. The batteries can last a long time if you just use a microcontroller on its own. But with the Arduino platform, the batteries go dead over time because the platform itself draws power even if you're not using it. So, but there are now, probably thousands and thousands, if not tens of thousands, of open source projects online that anyone can download and put into their Arduino and make function according to all sorts of different things with just a handful of electronic parts. Anything from telling you when to water your plants to tweeting about when your toilet flushes, or making noise and lights and music, or anything from practical to purely artistic to totally whimsical. People have created projects for Arduino that are free for the download.
If I can just add, and one of the things I've seen is that, because traditionally microcontroller and embedded programming has been considered for professional use only. And it's always been a very complex task in order to, because you had to write everything from scratch. But now that it's like kind of now with the platform and all the available source code and libraries, then people are actually implementing things that they've always thought should have been implemented, and that's like leading to a lot of interesting applications. And I think that's why I think environmental monitoring is something that people would be very interesting to see what types of applications people could come up with, for something like in something like that. So that's my main reason for trying to do a low power board.
The whole thing should be that the only limitation for what you can make with a microcontroller is your imagination, and as it turns out, that's limitless.
Akiba, why did you went for environmental control? Was there any particular reason why you choose this function?
It's always been an interest of mine, especially like for in terms of wireless sensor networks. Then I think the most useful application of wireless sensor networks is for environmental monitoring. And I'm not just talking about ecological, I'm talking about like monitoring your immediate environment. I think, you can, if you can easily set up a network, a wireless network where you just kind of stick nodes onto your walls, then, you can like maybe increase the safety of your house by having, like real time alarms that might email you if there's something out of the ordinary happening, like a potential fire or like a gas leak sensor or something like that. But the biggest obstacle, wireless sensor networks is actually very complicated because you have to deal with power management issues as well as complex communication protocols and also the application interfacing the sensors, et cetera, et cetera. And so, but the Arduino is simplifying a lot of that, which is what I'm seeing. And it's, so now I'm trying to simplify it even more. At least the other parts that need to be kind of in place.
Yeah, well, you're taking away one of its limitations that, kept it from being used for a whole bunch of cool things.
Yeah. I don't see it as that. I just think, I see it as a cool wireless sensor platform.
Well, it is.
About which size are we speaking? I mean, I know normal Arduinos are a bit smaller than a cigarette pack. And are these energy efficient ones smaller or bigger? Or what are we talking about?
I think it depends. I don't really like a form factor. Like for me, I always like the form factor will depend on I'll probably choose an enclosure, especially so for the low power boards, I have some prototypes that I have, but the final board design will be defined by the enclosure. And so right now I'm looking at these IP65. Industrial water resistant enclosures, which I think would be weatherproof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the size will be defined by the final enclosure, which is also a very important part of the overall usage.
And have you thought about which license or definition you want to use for the sensors, or is there are there any restrictions when you use Arduino as a basement?
Well, everything I've designed so far is just free for anyone to the design, the schematics, and I don't use Eagle, so I don't use Eagle, so I can't give out the Eagle file because I don't have one. But the schematics, and I have the PDFs of the layout. But I think, basically, you're free to take the schematics and copy them. It's all Creative Commons essay, share and share alike. And all my software is, I'm using modified BSD, which is the most commercial friendly license, I guess, or the most free license that you can use, because I want people to pick up the designs and play around with them, play around with the software. And I received a lot of excellent feedback, especially on bugs that I would have never had the breadth of testing, that I would have, not having it open source.
I find it interesting because a friend of mine did a similar project also on embedded BSD. It was, It was an embedded Tor node, which only. You only need to plug it in and you immediately have a Tor node running, which is something really cool. He is working sometimes on a Tor project, and this thing, really has a good usage. And sadly, he didn't receive any helpful feedback at all. And I wonder if he was probably on the wrong spot or. Maybe you can tell us what are some tricks to get attention for your hardware project, especially if it's not something that blinks.
Well, you just have to make it something that other people like. When you put something out in the world open source, it doesn't mean that you have everyone jumping on it and wanting to work on it. But if people resonate with it, then they will. So it doesn't have to be blinky lights or noisemaker. It just has to be something that people are intrigued with for whatever reasons enough to want to work on it.
And I think the biggest thing is training. Like, you need to have, like, tutorials, and, like, initially you need to actually do a lot of hand-holding, you know. Like, open source itself doesn't mean, like, you know, people are going to be, or as Mitch said, people won't be beating down on your doors. You have to hand-hold people, show them how it's used, show them what they can use it for, and have tutorials. And then, and over time, as people kind of slowly trickle towards it, then it'll start building momentum.
Yeah, you want to make it easy on people to understand, you know, as easy as possible, which means easy for people to learn how to use your project, and develop on it, you know, to use your tools. So you want to use tools that people can, pick up on wherever possible. And, you know, and if you're using your own tools, then make those tools, you know, if you develop your own tools, then making those available too, but, you know, making it as easy and fun as possible, and with a website that's inviting, you know, inviting looking. You don't want to scare people away.
Now, as we've talked about momentum, and I have now, I mean, I'm very happy that I have you two as guests, and maybe you can name some resources, some tutorials for complete beginners. I mean, Mitch, I know your book is not finished yet, but maybe we got someone interested in the channel who's listening and who would like to know more about this hardware thing, who would like to get his hands or her hands on something. Where should they start?
Oh, this is, Mitch is an excellent teacher, so he should.
Yeah, but if we don't have a hackerspace around, and if Mitch is not in on the continent right now, what else could?
No. I'm just saying he should handle this one, because he'll probably.
Well, the thing is, I wish there was a book that already existed that could teach people who know nothing how to get started, because then I wouldn't have to be writing this book that's been taking me almost 2 years to write. But there are a bunch of really great resources online for helping people get going. In my workshops, the way I teach people is by having an array of very easy to complete kits. And a kit is a really good way to start, because you don't need to know anything at all to make a kit. All you need to be able to do is know how to solder. And there are many good tutorials online about how to solder. And I've taught, like, well over 10,000 people how to solder personally. And many of those people have taught other people. And there are a lot of great videos online about how to solder, as well as step-by-step pictures. There's also a one-sheet comic reference of my technique. Soldering is easy comic, you'll definitely find just solder comic. When you make a kit, you really don't need to know anything to successfully complete it if it's one that has good step-by-step instructions. So if you can do that, then you can accomplish actually building something. But it's really nice to know what the parts you're using do. And if you just know a very few basics of electronics and of microcontrollers, then you can put those basics together in simple ways to do so many way cool things. And once you play with that a little bit, you can put those simple things together in more and more complex ways to make amazing things. So there's really only a couple things necessary for anyone to learn how to do this stuff, because it really isn't difficult. It's just a handful of simple things that you can put together in simple ways to start, and then in more and more complex ways, putting the simple things together to make more complex things. But you can make way cool things by putting simple things together in simple ways, and with just your interest and enthusiasm, you'll make the time to play with this so you'll learn more. And that's really all that's necessary. And the resources online, there's instructables.com is a great place to go to see all sorts of amazing projects that people have created on their own or with the help of others, and then sharing them with step-by-step pictures and instructions on how to make the project. Many of them are really, really good. Lady Ada is a fantastic resource also. She has all these really easy to make kits and fantastic documentation on how to assemble them with tutorials on what how they work. And everything I do is my documentation about everything I do is modeled after hers, because her method is so clear and easy and inviting. So my website, cornfieldelectronics.com, the Maker Faire tab has all my projects, and all my projects are incredibly well documented, designed so that people can learn by reading my documentation. And, like I said, I patterned all that after Lady Ada. And so if you go to Adafruit, Adafruit.com, you'll see all of Lady Ada's, projects and all of her cool documentation. There's also evilmadscientist.com. They have a lot of cool projects, also incredibly well documented. And there are many, many other people who make kits that are designed to teach people as they go along. Lady Ada also has a user forum for all of her projects online. There are also user forum online for AVR family of microcontrollers, which is the family of microcontrollers used for Arduino, and the ones used for pretty much all of Evil Mad Scientist, Lady Ada, and my projects, and I think most, if not all, of yours, Akiba, too, right?
Yes.
So AVRfreaks.org, AVRfreaks. AVRfreaks.org is geeks all over the planet.
I think it's AVRfreaks.net, I believe.
.net. Thank you for the correction. Yeah, and there are geeks all over the planet who are awake 24/7, just waiting for you to ask a question, no matter how total beginner you are or how expert you are. People are willing to help out with your project. And of course, there are hackerspaces all over the planet now, full of people who love helping and sharing to help people learn. So,
One more online resource that wasn't mentioned, but Make Magazine has a lot of tutorials and videos online as well, and a special site dedicated to Arduinos for people that are interested in it.
Yeah, they just started makeprojects.com.
Great. I hope this helps get people going, and I will include the links in the show notes so you can click on them. And yeah, I think now we did a very genuine show, and yeah, I'm happy with the topics we had, and I'm very happy with you two as guests, and thank you for the time. And yeah. Then I hope also the listeners said something for them, and I think we can say goodbye.
Yeah,
great.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for and Mitch, thanks for helping us start Tokyo Hackerspace.
Sure, and I'm glad to be of help any way I can. So yeah, it's cool talking to you and you too, Thomas, and we'll be seeing you, Akiba, in San Francisco soon, and I'll be seeing you, Thomas, in Chaos Camp in August.
Yeah,
or actually,
I hope so.
NinjaCon before that in Vienna.
Oh yeah, of course. We're already planning the next NinjaCon, and we already have the tagline. It's I decided it, but I'm not sure if I can say it correctly. It's something like the let's take or no, it's the privilege escalator to shell.
Nice.
Totally geeky and wonderful.
It was a long cocktail night till we came up with this one, but I'm very happy with it.
Good. Well, I look forward to all that.
Yeah, that's for people who don't know it and who are in Vienna or in Central Europe in summer. It's a conference in Vienna, very, I don't know, cozy one. We always have many sofas and very international guests. It's also a tiny conference, usually around 50, maximum 80 people. And yeah, Mitch will be there. And I don't know, is Jimmy also coming?
Probably.
Yeah, would be great. Yeah, good. So, but that's it for today from Signal and Talking Anthropology. My name is Thomas Lohninger, and I hope you enjoyed the show, and see you soon.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
See ya.